Sorry for the abrupt ending. I'm still getting the handle of them.
I don't think it's so bad. It looks nice, at least.
It's pretty fun. Well, welcome everybody to post game 40, man. What a journey. Man, we're getting close to 50 episodes. That'll be exciting.
I like almost didn't want to believe it was 40. That's why I accidentally put 39 up. It's like you don't want to believe it's your 30th birthday, that sort of thing.
Well, with the podcast, it's like there's something that feels very I don't know. You feel accomplished, obviously, getting the numbers up. And it's nice to sort of have a catalog and not just be starting and sort of know where you stand. But it also means you have less excuse for all of our fuck ups when we're just
That's
like
true, yeah.
unable to get streams to work or whatever. So we've been doing this long enough now that we should know. But
Yeah.
no, we do a good job and we appreciate all of y'all's patience when we don't.
Do a great job, and more people are saying it.
More and more people are saying every day.
Well, speaking of people who have a lot of technical issues despite having streamed for an awful long time, I want to open up the segment for a little, I guess, the crypto minority report, which is that David and I have very much come to conclusions, I think, about this whole enterprise, and don't think very much of it. I think it's kind of just all marketing for a speculative asset, primarily. But we will still air takes about crypto and maybe promise of it, or maybe sort of interesting takes we haven't considered as they come through to us. And this comes from Your Kickstarter Sucks. This is Mike Dogboner Hale, episode 222, Bat in the Cave. And let me just share this. I think this is something I certainly hadn't considered about crypto before Mike brings this up. And oh right, so I have to do entire screen. There we go. Here we go.
Well, that was the update on the old Kickstarter
If you
falling short, you know.
went back in time and showed like a caveman a lazy ape NFT, it would blow his mind. It really would blow his mind.
So yeah, I think that's interesting to think about. If you showed a caveman a lazy ape NFT, an NFT is this non-fungible token, showed it to a caveman, it would blow his mind. So
Do you have a lazy ape?
A lazy ape. I do have actually the card. The lazy ape
I'm just saying, because
NFT.
if people, some people follow this more than others, and like this shit is actually so funny, because all of these, this has been sort of Twitter discourse recently. This guy, these guys have been selling these these NFTs of cartoon animals.
Yeah, I think do I have it up? Is this what
Oh,
I'm
here
putting
we
up?
go.
And this doesn't have any kind of price history yet, but you can click on it there. Pretty amazing stuff. I mean, this is technology in its infant stages. This isn't feeding anybody at this point. But who knows? This might be as impactful as the internet, as some crypto boosters like to say. The internet. The most impactful invention of maybe the last half millennium. Of course, another one of those bound to be right around the corner, and some people think it's in these lazy ape NFTs. So we'll be monitoring that to see if we're wrong or not.
Well, hold up.
One.
Look at this.
I
You got a few now.
got a what?
I want to show them the other ones. The I don't. I'm not up to date on all the different names for the.
Do you know the history of these a little bit more better than I do?
Do you know them?
Not
Because
really, no.
I was thinking about this, which is these other guys that people have been selling. These are the ones that have been selling for a lot of money.
Okay.
People are really into these,
Sort of
like
like knockoff
very
gorillas characters.
lazy lion. So these guys, and like honestly, the funniest thing about them is they're being pushed as, again, like these are NFTs, non-fungible tokens, right? Which is like the new weird ass internet scam. And these pretty much like they are all selling for like a decent amount of money. 7.3 million. I don't know how accurate this is, but I'm not going to spend too much time on all this. Bored Ape Yacht Club analysis, $7.3 million.
What are people doing?
People have been spending like a shitload of money on these things. But if you look closely, I mean, they're not even like uniquely drawn. I mean, they're pretty much like, I don't know, like video game renderings, you know, that are easily customizable that you can add different things to. And people are like, you know, buying them and then putting them as their Twitter profile picture. Which is hilarious, especially since all you have to do to get those for free is
take a screenshot.
I have a new technique for folks who have, you know, are curious. You can just do this right here.
The one thing the NFT industry doesn't want you to know about.
Anyways, but go back to how that would blow a caveman's fucking mind.
Yeah. I mean, that's all you have to think about is it blows caveman's mind. It also blows a lot of modern humans' minds, apparently.
I mean, it's honestly pretty sad if you think it is that we have all of these capabilities right now, and like it's just being used for the cheapest scams.
Well, it's funny. Like I used to compare it to like Bitcoin to like the Teletubbies, Beanie Baby sort of like craze, right? And it's now it's literally just fucking digital Pokemon cards.
All these like old sweaty cartoons. Guys like buying up all of the shit.
And you know, that reminds me like the whole the dream about collecting basketball cards and stuff like that. And it's like the reason that you don't think that through, like the reason that actually it might pay is because some of those motherfuckers never grew up and they just continued to be. And I don't want to bash it too much because I still like that I have those Michael Jordans in the back. But it's a business and it's a big investment to a lot of people. And I think there's something a bit sort of, I guess it speaks to maybe man's search for meaning in
man's search for money more than anything.
Right. I mean, that's where, but like, I think it's a mix with some people or they combine that same thing. Like how much sort of valuable cards I got or NFT, like that becomes, how much you enjoy life almost, like how much money, how much those are appreciated in value. It's really depressing to think about, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt that as a kid. Like, I'm like, I've mowed how many lawns, and every fucking time I just go and drop that on a box of fucking, like, basketball cards. And, like, what is it getting me? Like, I got some cool cards. I got, like, a Carmelo rookie. But like, I also got a giant stack of cards from guys that I'll never think about again. Like, and I don't know. It's just kind of, you look at it and it's like, what am I getting from this?
I mean, so here you are, Matt. I mean, everybody, Matt is telling you don't buy any NBA cards or MLB cards. No, I mean, it's funny. I've been a personal hobby of mine is to like, look at like weird Yelp reviews of different businesses around like anywhere, but like particularly Austin, and you get some really funny ones. Cause Austin has like not that it's unique. I'm not trying to say that it's not, there aren't other places where this is the case, but Austin has always had a pretty big like nerd culture. Right. I mean, it was a weird town for a long time before the tech freaks came in, but reading the reviews of guys who like got burned trying to resell like their Magic the Gathering cards, like their first edition Magic the Gathering cards at like a game store here, and be like, they don't give you fair prices, and you know, they know the market value of this card was over $1,000 and they only gave me $400. Well, no thank you, sir. And I'm just imagining just being an adult and like flipping out about that shit is very funny to me.
That is super funny. It's also funny to imagine yourself being the crooked hobby shop owner. like I've been fleecing these kids for like 15 years, and now this internet shit is really gonna fuck up my business.
Oh my lord. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is like there's always been weird shit that people spend their money on, and look, all power to all of you. I mean, whatever, you know, gets people going, but like the markets of these things, the way people try to make money off them is always going to be really fucking funny. And the NFTs are just amazingly I don't know, peculiar to me, because I just, except if you just, if like the only pleasure that you get out of those things is just saying that you own it, I can't see any like value in that. And I don't see the value in that personally for almost anything. I don't know. I'm not a collector of that kind of stuff. I have things that I collect, I guess, that I like or like to use or like to maybe look at from time to time. But to just be like, yeah, I own this like JPEG is very funny to me.
Yeah. It's really stripping it to the essence of like the part that's sad about it. Like you don't even get to like, I like collecting hats. I love buying hats, but that's cause I like to walk down the street with it. It's catch my reflection. Be like, oh, that hat looks good. Like it's not, that's mine. And actually like I could prove it. Like, who cares, man?
Yeah, I mean, you've cut out every other pleasurable aspect of owning something except for just like the ownership token. And again, yeah. I mean, we didn't mean to turn this into an NFT thing. I mean, the funniest thing is that even that like token, that like proof of ownership is like very unlikely to last very long. Because if any of those companies just go under,
it lasts as long. Yeah, it lasts as long as the hosting company.
Yeah, so the company that hosts.
Like, so what? You're really buying a stake in like a hosting company. but it cuts out the middleman. Okay, amazing, very cool. let's move on here. I'm gonna share my screen. I'm gonna just check up on some guys here. Ben Shapiro and Dave Rubin. I was just out of curiosity, wanted to go through some of their old tweets and see what they had sort of historically said about vaccines. Just to bring up, like, for instance, what Ben Shapiro said most recently about vaccines. Parents are going to be extremely hesitant to vax small children, and that hesitancy is entirely justified. COVID risks to children are extraordinarily low. Unvaxxed kids are safer than vaxxed adults, and there is no seriously longitudinal data on vaccine risks to small children. Now, I think fairly straightforward anti-vax statement sentiment there. Their children die, several. Mm-hmm. It's not hundreds yet. Hopefully it never gets to be that much. But the other thing you have to think about is the teachers that are forced to work and teach these kids. But let's just go through and see if this matches up to the previous statements on vaccines, or if maybe something besides principle is animating their statements on this. Now, I would show you Dave Rubin's most recent statements on vaccines, but this little mission of mine got me blocked by Dave at long last, so I can't do that. But anyway, September 12, 2011, Ben Shapiro says, does anybody disagree with the notion that we should give Ron Paul the HPV vaccine? Now, this is came up in the context of the Gardasil vaccine for HPV that Rick Perry came out against in the presidential debates leading up to the election. And you see both Shapiro and Rubin saying, like, this is ridiculous, like, anti-vax. This is back when the anti-vaxxers were left, right? Remember, and that's out the window now because we got midterms to win. Just a more here. This is February in 2015. Tell us about this. Is when there was a rise in measles, mumps, rubella, especially in places like California. So the right and Ben Shapiro is really jumping in on how we're the pro-vax people. Tell us about science, Dems who link autism with vaccines, and then does his pro life stuff. Never take a stress test. Chances of death, according to the NIH, 1 in 5,000. That's exponentially higher than the chances of death due to vaccine. And here's another one. If you don't believe in vaccines but believe in homeopathic balms and Kabbalah string, this sort of crap is on you. More little girls were made mentally handicapped by the GOP debate about Gardasil than by the vaccines. One of the, and then again, I see if I can find here, Nathan Bernard found a useful thing. Shapiro previously had written, Americans have short memories and enormous confidence in junk science. Parents will ignore vaccinations but ensure that their kids are stocked up with the latest homeopathic remedies. Blah, blah, blah. When it comes to measles and mumps and rubella and polio, your right to be free of vaccination and your right to be a dope with the health of your child because you believe Jenny McCarthy's idiocy ends where my child's right to live begins. Fairly straightforward and commonsensical statement there on vaccines. Mm. And just to go with Dave Rubin here, who was even more you know, anti-vaccine now recently. Like I said, I can't show examples because he blocked me. But I can't believe this is in 2015. I can't believe we're debating whether kids should get vaccines. What's next? Does gravity really exist? I bought my science guru Cara Santa Maria to the Real Roseanne's Kitchen to clear up confusion of the vaccine. And then he hits Rick Perry, which is actually a good joke. One of the decent jokes that I've seen Dave land is, sources, Rick Perry backtracks on HPV vaccine stance, says he thought he was giving the girls a lethal injection. That was 2000. Okay,
there you go, Dave. There you go. I mean,
that was over a decade ago, but, you know, he had it. He had his fast. That was when Dave had his actual progressive FASBA. This is a test of the emergency idiot system. Retweet if you're for vaccines, fave if you're against. That's the one that I retweeted and ultimately got me blocked. But let's just, and I wouldn't, I'm actually going to reach out to Cara Santa Maria because I'm a fan of her work. She's on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, which is one of the original podcasts that got me listening to podcasts regularly. I'm curious what she has to say about this because Skeptic's Guide has done great work during COVID against misinformation. But here's Dave talking to her.
No sound, Matt. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. You know, I think I don't even know if we need sound for that. Like, you get the point. Like, he's talking to her. He's saying all the things that you would be saying. Like, the way we get rid of these things is by getting people vaccinated on a wide scale. Basic stuff that is inconvenient now if you're trying to harvest resistance to vaccines for political campaigns, basically. So that's your principled.
I mean, you know, the money wasn't there. I mean,
it's fascinating. It is fascinating to see this because you see that like that the map here that I have up shows the, and I'll just, that's, they saw this as an opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. Fundamentally, like this growing spread of anti-vax sentiment over the years, like Republicans can't say no to natural, organic sort of sentiment that's sort of hospitable to reactionaries because like their actual agenda is toxic to normal people. You can't say like we want to lower taxes and stuff, right? And so like anytime there's something like this, they literally cannot say no to it.
And it was, I mean, it was such a, I mean, not exclusively by any means, but like the anti-vaccine stuff was, I don't know, left maybe in the most generalized sense, but certainly like granola hippies.
Yes.
So it is, I mean, and that's why Ben Shapiro was dunking on it for so long until it became like, okay, they're going to become the anti-vaccine movement because of Donald Trump, by like some extension.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's cynical stuff for sure. And
it's devolution, really.
It's devolution. I mean, it's just funny to see Shapiro moving from being like, oh, this is a great chance that I can make fun of the long-haired cornrows white lady hippies, you know, to now being like, this is the most important fight of all time. This is the most important fight for democracy we've ever had.
Yeah, because he's smart about it. Like, he originally was just taking issue with the constitutionality of the mandate, which is mm-hmm. the smart way of saying like, of hiding like, hey, I might actually think this is the wise thing to do itself. And years later, I might want to be able to say like, I would have been for that actually, but it's just constitution doesn't allow it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then you like, ultimately that gravity just keeps pulling you forward. So you have to say things about like repeat the stuff about, it might be dangerous. Who knows? We don't know. We know exactly like, kids are dying from COVID, even if it's not that much, like they're dying from it. And anyway, that is your cool kids philosopher and the dumb wounded antelope themselves, basically in the same, you know what I'm talking about? When Joe Rogan called Dave the wounded antelope.
Oh shit. Yeah.
Yeah. But so, basically the birds of a feather.
Yes. No, I've just been looking for the, have you seen the COVID rant with the guy who's wearing like a neon green t-shirt and he has a Statue of Liberty on it?
No, I've not seen this.
Oh, I need to find, because it's probably one of my, I've watched it. I found some, this is post game. Well, just give me a second to find it, because it is actually so good. It's one of the funniest things I've seen in a long time. The only videos I can find, though, are where this guy like does a, oh, here we go. Matt Baker. Sorry for the delay, but it'll be worth it. Yes. Okay, this is actually awesome too, because, all right, I'm sorry for the delay, everyone, but it'll be worth it if you haven't seen this, and if you have, I'm sorry. I'm also sorry for everybody, because this is quite disturbing, but it's also very funny.
Oh god.
Let me get it. Wait, share screen. Sorry, I'm still learning how to do this. Here we go. Oh, does this not let you do the sound?
You have to share either the Chrome tab or the full screen to do sound, unfortunately.
Okay.
If you want to bring it up, I can bring it up on my screen. If you want to chat it to me.
Oh, yeah. You got it. This is a good one, too, because the caption on this is also like a lunatic. I'm sending this to Matt, and as I'm sending it to him, I do have to say that like a lot of the COVID... I don't know, reactionary shit has been a very funny like meeting of like a very specific kind of conservative Christian evangelical freak with the more fringes of like granola America, which I gotta say, like, I grew up in, and you know, I'm still sort of a part of to some extent, or at least I'm adjacent to it. So it's a funny alliance to see these people sort of working together, because they're not typically friends. All right, do you have it?
Yeah, I should be sharing it now. You see it?
Bones begging you to do the right thing.
Sir, can you please state your name for the audio record?
That
sir?
Matt Baker is calling upon from Ocean Beach. The wind that is blowing through the black people, through the white people, through the Chinese people, through the Mexican Americans, to the people that built this building with their bare hands to raise up this nation. They are begging you, and they are blowing through your veins, and they should be putting a tingle up the spine of your okay. back, and they should be begging you to do the right thing. You're about to open a pit of hell. You do not get a vaccine passport put on us. You know, as the population who's in control, you know that the people or the politicians, once you get a power, you will never relinquish it. Do you think that the 4 feet of marble that holds you above high in this chamber will help you from the fate of humanity which you are unleashing? No! It won't! Your children and your children's children will be subjugated! They will be asked, how many vaccines have you had? Have you been a good little Nazi? Hey, Fauci! Hail Fauci! Hail Fauci! Hail Fauci! There's been a lot of talk about the Nuremberg Code. Well, I brought you a copy. You are all in violation of Section 1. Yes, you, Dr. Wilton. You are in violation of the Nuremberg Code, which is international law, and the definition is...
Thank you, sir. Your time has expired.
The definition is, we shall not be coerced. All of this is coercion. The vaccine...
That's it. I mean... Obviously, I mean, you feel a little bad because it's like there's definitely some disturbing stuff going on there, but it starts really strong with all the when he lists all the different races.
I got bad news for him if he thinks saying this is in violation of international law is going to stop anyone in American power. But
not only that, Matt, but like the thing is like. And this is why this movement is like, it's sort of funny to me, because the kind of merging of like, I think this is just, I mean, again, like I think a lot of this stuff comes from like a semi, like, you know, I mean, like a genuine like distrust of like the state and the government. The problem is like there's just so much shit out there that you can start from that position, just end up like on a completely other planet. But yeah, as you were saying, like it's really funny not only in America to say like, yeah, you need to follow international law, but two, that the conservative movement has attached itself to that kind of stuff too, because there's nothing that the conservatives hate more than the idea of them ever using or enforcing international law in the United States.
Does capitalism violate the Nuremberg codes?
I mean, honestly, I don't know the statute well enough to say, but I do think it's very amazing to, even if it were true, to print it out in color too. And bring that to your school board meeting. But anyways, yeah, that's a very, very powerful message there. And it's made me rethink a lot of different things.
Yeah.
I also like, look, and you and I like are very, like, I'm a huge critic of Fauci, and like, hell, like I get in a lot of trouble. I'm not as like militant. I don't know. Like, I think a lot of the ways that we've dealt with this pandemic have been inadequate and quite shameful, but and I'm not a fan of Fauci at all. But it is funny, like, the stranglehold he has over all of them. Like, the, I don't know, this, like, tiny little guy is, like, you know, ushering in a new Reich or something.
Right. And, I mean, it sort of makes sense in the sense that, like, they're so conditioned for to look for a deep state sort of, like, Benedict Arnold. And he's the only really visible one there, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, and even he, I don't know, like you said, like I have no portfolio to defend Fauci. I think he probably should have resigned.
I mean, that's the thing is like, you and I are sitting here like, how dare he like malign like Fauci.
It's like, but like hail Fauci. And it's like, I'm sorry, if we're talking about the coercion in this country, I'm going to start at, I said, with Max, like, I do think if a worker, wants to make that, chip to ask for a raise saying like, I got to get new different, inoculations to go work for your ass. I think it's fair enough.
Yeah.
But like, you have to ground that in a conversation about the actual coercion that goes on in the society, such like evictions, this like student loan stuff, the just like the natural having to work for a boss during a pandemic at all, you know, it's like you're almost there, man. But it's not fucking, it's not Fauci the Hitlerian mastermind of like controlling your future generation. They're going to be controlled the same way you are by fucking capitalists. If something,
yeah, exactly. I mean, that's you're so right, Matt. It's like, that is the kind of, you know, gallows humor, I guess. But like, you know, in this country, and specifically, I will say, I know that's a California crew, but like, there is such talk of like, oh man, they're going to come, and like the authoritarians are in the South. I'm saying like the authoritarians are coming, big government's coming. They're going to start telling you what to do. They're going to coerce you. You're not going to be able to make your own decisions about your life. And it's like, son, we're already living in that dystopia. It's called capitalism.
Yeah.
I know, it's just like an amazing thing to like, to be living in this hellscape. Right. And like to have so much of your life like predetermined for you by like the zip code that you're born into.
Yes.
Right. To have like all of this shit going on around you, and instead of just confronting that, like creating boogeymen to like get worked up about with your friends, I mean, you can
because
see
they
why
don't want you to die. Like, they don't want you to die and kill your family with a virus. Like,
yeah,
they have ways to track you. That's the other thing. It's like it's some sort of tracking, or the, like they fucking everything that you're worried about, they fucking done already.
I know that. I mean, that's the real tragedy. I mean, yeah. Regardless, we don't want to overanalyze it. That's a very, very funny video, and I probably won't watch that for a few years unless they come and rip my arms off one day.
Set that to music, yeah.
Some Discord, you know, people have set it to music. Honestly, not to get to turn this into like a comedy criticism podcast, but I'm sort of done with that shit.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, maybe.
I think so for like normal people. Like, I mean, I think it's so funny to put like Joe Biden, I want to put him over. Trump, I always want to put him over music when he goes.
Oh, yeah. A while, but like, I mean, I don't want to come down too hard, but you know what I'm talking about? Like in like the 2010s, like anytime something happened, they turn into an auto-tune song.
Oh, yeah. That was
horrible. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody does that with death metal, with that guy, which does work.
Yeah, oh, that, yeah, basically there. I can almost hear like the double bass drum. Yeah.
All right, should we do some questions before we get too derailed here?
Yeah, let's do it.
Edwin wants to ask David, in case you didn't see it last week, what lessons are there to be learned from with regard to Michael Moore era left wing? And how would you differentiate that era and its traditions from something like Occupy? Matt, were you ever a big Michael Moore guy?
I was a decent Michael Moore guy. Like, it's weird. I'm trying to think, like, I kept him a little bit at arm's length. But I, every time he had something come out, I enjoyed it. Like, Roger and Me was, I remember Netflixing that when they used to give you the DVD in the mail. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was good. I remember enjoying it. I haven't seen it in a while. But it's like, I'm having a hard time, like, considering, like, leftism at that time sucked.
It was horrible. Yeah, man.
Like, and, but I don't know if, like, Michael Moore is, like, Michael Moore was, like, almost a way out a little bit. Like, the things he was focusing about, like, capitalism and, like, healthcare and stuff like that. At least he was, like, focused on some of the right.
Yeah, what was his healthcare movie?
Oh, I don't know now. But he gave it away for free, I remember.
Yeah, and he was doing it at the time when they were pushing Obamacare, right?
Yep, exactly. And that was really, I think, that's smart on his part. Like, I was ready to pay attention at that time and remember
downloading that. 2007, so that was before.
Yeah. What is it called?
Sicko.
Sicko, right. Sicko, right. Yeah, yeah. I don't know, like...
What was that? Just the time of, I mean, honestly, that's like enemy camp shit for me. Cause, like, I mean, what? 2000s, I was in high school when that was going on. So
yeah.
I was still just like, I don't know, a little shit. like, yeah. Conservative leaning, I guess, at that point. What I'm saying is, like, my analysis of Michael Moore era leftism would be like, those are the most extreme dangerous threats to the United States. I mean, obviously, I have some understanding of it now. I mean, if you are really interested in that question, you know, Luke Savage, and I can't remember the other co-host, I'm sorry, has a podcast called Michael and Us, which you could listen to.
Oh, interesting.
Where they sort of, because they were very influenced by Michael Moore's leftism. So if that's like something of interest to you, that's definitely a place probably to go to. You'll get deeper answers than this. I mean, I think, like, more than anything, that era of Michael Moore stuff was just like, we're smart, like, the idiots are in charge and we need to get the smart guys back in charge. It was like in a kind of a little bit too much of an appeal to reason to sort of mask the reason why things are the way that they are.
I think the John Stewart thing really encapsulates it more than any Michael Moore thing with the rally to restore sanity.
You know, I went to that.
So did Chris, my buddy Chris. Both my Texas friends were really into restoring sanity at that time.
Yeah, what a wild. I mean, it was such one of the most embarrassing things I've ever participated in. but yeah, I mean, like, because for me, I was thinking that way too. I mean, John Stewart and those guys were, I think, I had more experience with them than Moore.
Right.
But I mean, like, I don't know. Like, I mean, the thing is, like, I don't want to trash Michael Moore too much. I think there's like a limit to his politics and his outlook, but he was saying shit, real shit, when a lot of people were too afraid to talk truth. I mean, I know in the movie Sicko, he has a whole thing about Cuba.
Yeah.
Which I think is quite important.
Yeah, honestly, like that those sorts of things are like, oops. Like, never mind if you agree with like Michael Moore's recent tweets or whatever, but like giving you the content with which to like understand the Cuban system.
Yeah.
That's important work.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think if we're going to be to compare that to Occupy, I think the big difference between maybe Moore and that might be less his fault, more like the times, is that there wasn't like the mass politics side of Moore's work as much, right? There was definitely like, you know, the people versus like the system for sure, but the kind of call to action was, I don't know, pretty mainstream, while Occupy had like a little bit more of a radical tinge to it. But Occupy was almost like not too radical, because I use radical as a positive most times. Occupy wasn't necessarily too radical, but it was like, I don't know, like, I don't know, too abstract maybe. I don't know. And it's like refusal to do anything with, I did a stream on it. I don't know if we ever talked about Occupy on the 10-year anniversary of it. But, you know, I mean, the big problems with Occupy, obviously, are that it was like a criticism of like a lot of existing systems, but it wasn't focused criticism. There's a lot of moralism in the discourse around it, which I'm sort of allergic to now, just because I could see where that ended. Right. I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think that those are really just different stages of a kind of lost movement, right? Michael Moore was pre-Occupy, and then Occupy was pre-Bernie, and they definitely all fed into each other. I will say the last time I saw Michael Moore in person was at J20 when Trump got elected. And I was there. I was one of the guys who was causing trouble, and I got hit pretty hard. I got hit over the head by a cop. I wasn't feeling too good, and I went and got treated at the medic tent, and I came back later. I can't remember exactly where in DC, but basically there were like two different rallies. There was like the actual rally that was the reason why people didn't show up to the inauguration, because people were literally physically blocking the entrance to the inauguration. And then there was like a big liberal pep rally, and Michael Moore was at that one. So I didn't feel too fondly for him that day, just because I've been put some skin in the game. But I don't know. I mean, Michael's all right. He says some funky ass shit. He was saying,
it was like, get rid of the Republicans.
Yeah, it's like, get rid of the Republicans are like the root of all evil, kind of shit. Which is, I don't know. But Mike, I don't know. Michael's all right. He's not the worst man out there.
Yeah, it's cool by me.
I'm trying to remember. Michael Moore did an interview, I think maybe with Alec Baldwin. Michael Moore was a big Oprah for President guy. No, we can move on. Let's see. Oh, we got plenty of questions. Matt, what are your favorite good Christopher Hitchens moments, and what are the worst bad Hitchens moments? Our good friend Burgess has been on Hitchens' kick, and he is probably my favorite guilty pleasure writer ever.
The one that comes to mind most often is when he had the father-son Nazis on.
That is a good one.
That's maybe the height. I also like anytime he's talking about George Orwell. There's one he's on with John Rodden. What's funny about that is I've heard John Rodden, it's on C-SPAN, I think, tell the story later, and he tells about how they were drinking significantly beforehand, and how that's basically how Hitchens always was. But I like Hitchens on that stuff. But really, like, him in the early 90s, late 80s on C-SPAN is where I like Hitchens.
I like my I like my Hitchens like I like my red wines. Young. He was I mean, his early stuff is honestly quite phenomenal, especially on foreign policy. I mean, the debates he was able to do were really phenomenal. There's one, it's the actor is before my time to remember his name, but there was an actor who was a big booster of the first Desert Storm, who Hitchens?
Charlton Heston.
Heston, yeah, thank you. Yeah, and Hitchens in that debate, like, starts asking him if he could name any countries that border Iraq.
Damn, yeah, that was so fucking
funny. Which is a good one. Hitchens had some really great conversations. Hitchens' debate on reparations is an interesting one to watch, just knowing how he turned out in the end. He has some really great. He has a debate against, which we should just do a thing on this. I think we either did it on TMBS or maybe even on Left Reckoning, but we can just re-up it. He does a debate with a bunch of objectivists, Ayn Rand lovers, defending socialism, and actually has some pretty interesting contributions. I would love to do more stuff on that. You know, in fact, like, I'm not taking credit for Ben's book at all, or the idea for it. But Ben, when him and I first started becoming drinking buddies and hanging out, we spent most of our evenings talking about Hitchens, because we both had like a mutual love, problematic fave for him.
Right.
So, so like Ben and I have been deep in discourse on that. So I'm really looking forward to reading his book and then also having more conversations with him on Hitchens, because I mean, I don't know. Hitchens is such a good character for this because he is an absolute pig. And like people always, whenever you say anything positive about any piece of work of his that you like, it's always like, oh, did you know that he is like a shithead? It's like, yes, I do. But I, you know, there's some things in his work that I at least found entertaining, if not interesting.
Yeah, I have this, Heston, but if you want to play it. So it's funny, when I was searching this, the second one that comes up is us with Ben and Michael on TMBS about a year and a half ago.
Second, till Desert Storm began and refuses now. This is a course of absolute folly. Let me ask a question to Mr. Heston. Can he tell me clockwise what countries have frontiers and borders with Iraq, starting from Kuwait?
Yes, indeed I can. Those borders are going to be very flexible, I think. And Iran and Iraq demonstrate that.
But it's interesting.
Let me come to...
It wouldn't take a minute.
Let me come to your comment. Kuwait, Bahrain, Turkey, Russia... Iran.
Exactly. You don't know where it is, in other words, do you? You have no idea where the country is on the map, and you're in favor of bombing it now rather than later, on the whim of a president.
Mr. Hitchens, if I can interject, that the instantaneous command of the geography of the region...
Oh, I don't know. I think if you're in favor of bombing a country, you might pay it the compliment of knowing where it is. This is the sort of instantaneous barbarism upon which people like Bush trade. If you were asked to bomb Iran tomorrow, you'd do that. A year ago or two, the United States was on the side of Iraq against Iran. A few years before that, it was on the side of Iran against Iraq. Now we're fighting the Iranians' war for them. Why is this sort of public opinion so reliable?
He can play. And I mean, if anything, like that's why the thing that's great about Hitchens is like, even dropping the politics for a second, he had a way that was very convincing to folks, and he was good at sparring. And
when he died, Martin Amis, his novelist friend, said he was the most terrifying rhetorician of our time. And I think like there's something to that, like his ability to put a fine point on things, both in debate like that, but in his essay writing too, is I think. Even if you disagree with it, it was really good at finding a way to phrase things.
There was a bar that I lived near when I was in D.C., and Hitchens was a regular there. And it's fun talking to the bartenders who had little funny stories or just remembrances of like this nice English guy had come in and just order scotch and hang out by himself and write and wouldn't bother anybody, would tip well. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to like over romanticize the character either, but. I mean, if anything else, like especially when I was younger and I was in school, like we were all big fans, and he's someone who's, I want to be able to talk about it at least instead of just this kind of simple minded, are you a good one or a bad one?
He made it cool to care about basically international affairs.
Yeah. And he's, you know. I think his breakup with socialism is actually quite disappointing. I never read anything of his that was actually very convincing, but a lot of his other stuff was interesting. I mean, I think he just got, honestly, I think DC got to him more than anything. It was a good town for him to be a kind of writer celebrity. It was probably one of the few places you could do that as like a political columnist. And I think he enjoyed the limelight. I mean, that's what Alexander Coburn says about him, is that Hitchens always sort of wanted to be a little famous. And once you start getting invited to those parts, I mean, Hitchens also, you know, grew up in a kind of military / working class family. And I think breaking into that world too, was beneficial, but we should save it. We should do a whole thing with Ben sometime soon. Ekin Erkin, how's it going, brother? Says, hey, Matt and David, pick one living conservative thinker and one dead conservative thinker whom you vehemently disagree with, but think would make for a worthwhile intellectual opponent. I do maintain, in the States, we are deprived of any such worthy opponents, but my own choices would be Peter Sloterdijk, living philosopher, and Eugene Baum Barwick, dead economist, and maybe Alexander Dugin, as far as the living go. Do you have any feelings on that?
I don't really. But if I had to say one, Charles Cook of the National Review, I don't think he's exceptionally smart or like a genius or anything like that, but I think he's very smart at picking his battles and not when knowing when to shut up and knowing what you can say on a subject. And I think that's frankly that's an interesting, because that's, I feel like, key to conservatism and not, well, I don't know. I guess Trump is the counterexample that says that maybe we're done with that, but he has a way of doing that I find sort of like intriguing to try to, you know, crack. Historically, I guess you could say someone like Edmund Burke would be interesting. I would say Nathaniel Hawthorne, though. Hawthorne wrote a campaign biography for Franklin Pierce, basically saying like, you know, let's relax on slavery. Like, it's God will get rid of it when it's time and stuff like that. So, and Hawthorne, otherwise, I'd have a lot more to talk about him besides politics, but he'd be my dead one.
I mean, wait, what are the parameters of the question?
Living or dead conservatives?
No, well, we're the intellectual opponent. I mean, somebody who I think like would be a tough debate. I mean, there's certainly folks on the right who you can think of. I mean, I think like Hayek would probably be somebody historical who is a terrible reactionary, but can be worthwhile to sort of read and engage with, at least to sort of introduce yourself to a way of thinking. I think, for example, Rand is just a complete like lunatic. And I don't think that reading her works are actually enlightening at all. But Hayek is not necessarily going to, I think, really push you to change your position, but I think maybe to understand where some of these folks are coming from. Contemporary, I mean, Sloterdijk, you know, I know like Michael's on a big Sloterdijk kick, actually, summer 2020. Sloterdijk probably is the most interesting of them all, but I think considering him in even the same kind of like caliber or like arena as most of the American, like, I don't know, right wingers or conservative movement would probably be a big insult to Peter.
Yeah.
I wish I had something more concrete, but it's you know, Corey Robin's book on the reactionary mind actually really moved me on like even having any kind of like intellectual sympathy for.
Yeah, me too. Like going into like Edmund Burke, basically like the line of Thomas Paine on Edmund Burke, which is you pity the feathers, but forget the dying bird. Basically like you're talking about Marie Antoinette, but forgetting about the population of French people, as like, that's what Edmund Burke's whole deal was. I think it's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, Corey Robin's book is really just read Corey Robin's book. Then you can stop having to worry about, am I missing something? I used to listen to so much of that Ricochet, the National Review sort of podcast network, like 5, 6, 7 years ago. And it's fucking bullshit. You're wasting your time because they're going to talk about culture war bullshit all the time, frankly, often. Like, that's why, like, Barry Weiss returns to the guy who called the... remember when she did that article about maybe the guy who called the cops on the woman who's... No, the woman who called the cops on the bird watcher in Central Park, right? Like, they return to shit like that. Like, that's the level they love to talk about that stuff because it's divorced from, like, any real shit.
I 100% agree. I mean, like, don't get me wrong. I don't wish for like some resurgence of like an intellectual right wing movement or anything like that. But you know, Ben had a good tagline in an essay. What was it? Quillette that he published this in. Yeah. I mean, that, honestly, that's almost like a relic at this point, ain't it? But Ben published a piece like something like Marx deserves better critics.
Yeah.
which I think is very fair because it honestly is so sad to like It's like James Lindsay's the one who's out here being like, I'm the foremost expert on like Marxism and like postmodernism, etc. And like doesn't have like the faintest understanding of any of those concepts. It is sort of sent to spend so much time sort of reading and preparing yourself for certain arguments or ways of thinking and not really having anybody to fight with.
Because the work's done. Like they don't need to fucking think about it. It's already in like the world we live in. Like that work's all been done.
I think that's exactly right. we got a few here. The only right winger I debate with is David Horowitz. You know who that is, Matt?
Like a 90s
so he was
guy?
A Black Panther like sympathizer and like a member of like a lot of like radical left wing groups, and then had a full. Heel turn and is now like super reactionary right wing, but he actually I'm pretty sure like David Horowitz is like published in the New Left Review, so not just like I was a communist when I was young, like was writing interesting pieces that were being debated with I'd have to find it. It might not be New Left, it might be Monthly Review. But anyways, he had like pieces that were like actually like being dealt with by like Marxist intellectuals and was engaging with them one for one, and now writes pieces about how the communists are trying to destroy Easter.
The easier gig, honestly.
So that's the one I would like to debate because I think that'd be very funny. Samantha Sider says, I've been lucky that I've saved up enough money for a down payment. I'm trying to buy a home in my area. Hell yeah. Congratulations. Because I don't want to have to deal with my landlord. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. But the housing market has gotten so insane that every home is getting sold at $20,000 overbid to where I'm getting priced out of the market. Everyone I talk to says the market will come down eventually, but it's almost impossible to find something within my budget. And it only gets worse every week. Do you think the housing market will come back to sanity?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, right? Like at some point, like it'll come down. We'll get back up to productive capacity, I would think.
I mean, feeling's one thing, right? Like it's hard to sit around and predict, and like Matt and I'm not a real estate analyst or anything like that, so I can't give you proper advice. I will say I'd wait if I had money to put money on a house. Yeah. Because the markets are
Oops, David, are you there? Test 1, 2. So David's frozen, and I don't have actual control of any of this stuff. I wonder, and I can't even play a sound clip. So this might actually, I'm going to take a question while David kind of looks up into space there. Oh, he says Thunder just reset his electricity. So that'll be that. Let me see if I can get another Discord question while we're waiting there. Okay. That was a funny little pause face that David gave us. I'm going to scroll down. Let's go to the bottom because I'm not sure where he ended. Dave from Jamaica. I've taken Matt advice on having a lot more patience with the propagandized. That being said, speaking of crazy guys with dreads, when my car broke down, mechanic unleashed tons of vaccine misinformation thanks to Facebook. That said, how do we tackle things like Facebook from y'all's view? How do we tackle? I mean, I think it's the ideal way, or how is it going to be dealt with? Because I mean, I imagine how it's going to be dealt with is something along the lines of what the whistleblower suggested, which I'm not a fan of, which is creates like some sort of governing
Well, I'm back. I don't know if Matt is. Oh shit. I'm back now. I don't know if Matt is though. Where'd you go, Matt?
Yo, okay, yeah.
Did you cut off?
Yeah, I did a little bit. I kind of forgot where I was, but I was just talking about how we're dealing with Facebook.
Are we still live?
Yeah, we are. Okay. We're going. So basically,
crazy. I just storm outside. That's power went out.
That's awesome. The Texas storms. I think how it's going, how Facebook's going to be dealt with, if action is forthcoming, it's going to be what the whistleblower wanted, which is some sort of little body of former Facebook employees that can sort of have some semblance of. It'd be captured immediately, regulatory authority over it. And I think David froze again. So we might, this might be it. If he can get back on, we'll set up. He keeps freezing in those looking up at the sky poses. But Dave, I would say if I could do it ideally, it would be to empower the workforce to put out the product that they feel comfortable with. And then probably do something to the ads, and then use antitrust to break them up, get off WhatsApp, get off Instagram, break it all into separate things. So let's see. And I'm just going to go until David can knock us out here. I'm going to do one more question. Let's see here. I'm going to save that one for David Umberto Ionian and Kowalski. For my capstone course at university, I took a class called The Morality of Capitalism, where we read The Wealth of Nations, some book on Keynes, and Atlas Shrugged. We also went over history in the course. At the end, we were supposed to write a paper on whether or not capitalism could be moral. Interestingly, I said yes, but had to meet certain conditions, that being it could only be ethical in a democracy with equal representation. Again, like I would say, capitalism and democracy can't really do that, but I agree with you. If they could, it'd be nice. It had to have a well-regulated labor rights, and everyone would be provided free education as long as they sought without any financial implications limiting their capacity to learn. I scored like a 95 in the class, and my instructor basically said I'd came to him with a proto form of Christian socialism, apparently at first. I bring this up because Richard Wolf's video said socialism is the shadow of capitalism. I'm curious if by that he means that so long as material conditions exist, socialism is an inevitable outcome of capitalism, or am I missing something? I think that's very well put. And I haven't heard that by Wolf before, but I like that. I like that message. So, folks, David is going through some Texas floods now. Cue the Stevie Ray Vaughan riff. So it was very nice being with all of you tonight, and we will see you this weekend.